The message tonight is taken from Psalm 24, and the last verses of that psalm, from verse 7 to 10. And this psalm was composed by the sweet singer of Israel, King David. And it's interesting to look at the three psalms here. Psalm 22, as he was plucking his stringed instrument, which was like a harp, it had very mournful tones to it, describing the suffering of the Messiah. And then Psalm 23, the plucking is different. If you've ever had an experience of playing a musical instrument, you will know there are different moods. And now there is more of a comfort, more of a sweetness in the tone. And then, after Psalm 23, which is that, he sings this song of triumph. And I'm sure as he's plucking the strings here, it's no longer in a quiet, gentle manner, but full of vigor, because he is worshipping the Lord's victory over our enemies. And there is something very graphic about this psalm. The first two verses describe God's creation, that this whole world belongs to him and was made by him. And then the next verse of the psalm is verses 3 to 6, which describe the holiness of God. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord? Well, none of us by nature. There is none worthy, no, not one. And then in the climax of the psalm, you have this question and answer approach, which was started in verse 3. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in. And then, as this psalm was sung, one part of the congregation would sing, "Who is this King of Glory?" And the other would sing the answer, "The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle." And then it is repeated again. And there are different emphases, but it is the same truth. And in that rendition of the psalm that we sung so well, that came out as different parts of the congregation sang the question and the answer. Now, in case you're wondering, what is the gospel message in this psalm? Let me just give you the context to begin with. This psalm was composed when the Ark of the Covenant was brought back to Jerusalem. The Ark had been taken by the Philistines before David's time, and the Ark eventually was taken to the house of Obed-Edom. And eventually, it was time for the ark to return. And I'm just going to read the verses that describe that in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 12. "Now it was told King David, saying, 'The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God.' So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David." Note, with gladness. "And so it was, when those bearing the ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, that he sacrificed oxen and fatted sheep. And then David danced before the Lord with all his might." That's it. That's the atmosphere of this psalm, one of worship and triumph. "So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpets." And that is our desire for the people of God in our land, that we would once again be shouting for joy because our King has come. Now then, the ark, what is it? It's a type, it's a shadow of Christ. The ark signified the presence of God with his people. And that's who Jesus Christ is. God in our midst. Where was the ark being taken to? It was being taken to the tabernacle, which was going to become the temple, but it was still a tent at that point. What was the tent? Again, the tent was a type. A type of what? Again, God in the midst of his people. When Jesus Christ came to this world, he said, "You will destroy this temple," referring to himself, "and I will rebuild it in 3 days. God doesn't dwell in temples made with men's hands. He dwelt in the person of his Son, who came into this world 2,000 years ago. And so, the gospel here is this. It isn't just the Ark of the Covenant going up to the temple in Jerusalem that we're considering this evening. It is Jesus Christ entering not the temple made with hands, but entering into the kingdom of heaven. Let me read some other verses. I'm building a picture up here. This is why I'm giving you these important verses. In the letter to the Hebrews, in a chapter that we haven't been considering, chapter 9, in verse 12, it is put like this. Christ came, verse 11, as high priest of the good things to come, with a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood, he entered the most holy place, that in the tabernacle, once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. That's what this psalm is looking forward to. The entrance of King David's greater son into that kingdom. And then, I just want to give these verses in Revelation. It's a very sad scene at first that John is given a glimpse of in heaven, in Revelation 5. There's the book. Verse 2 of Revelation 5. I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose it seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look at it. So I wept much because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it. And isn't that the position that we find ourselves in as we read this psalm? The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. And when you behold the work of his hands, there is something amazing about it. But it doesn't give us any hope. In Moldova, we were most privileged on the clear night to look at the stars. It's not like seeing the stars in this country, because the city lights, and even out in the countryside, the street lights, they don't give a clear view of the stars. But in Moldova, the Milky Way looks so vivid, and there are so many stars. And when you consider what is man in comparison with such a vast universe, we don't feel hope. We feel a sense of awesomeness. And then when we consider the kingdom of God, heaven, who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? The angels that surround thy throne may bear that burning bliss, but that is surely theirs alone, for they have never ever known a fallen world like this. What's the answer? He who has clean hands. What do the hands mean? The hands mean the practicalities of life. None of us here have clean hands. We've all had our hands dirty in the things of the world. And it gets worse. It's not just clean hands, but a pure heart. Blessed are the pure in heart, said Jesus Christ, for they shall see God. But who here has that? Even when we desire to do good, evil is present within us. And then specifics are mentioned. Who has not lifted up his soul to an idol? Who here is innocent of that? None of us are. We all worship something or other, nor sworn deceitfully. Oh, how can I, whose native sphere is dark, whose mind is dim, before the ineffable appear, and on my naked spirit bear that uncreated beam. When those deacons on the Isle of Lewis in the middle of the 20th century were convicted as to their prayers and their Christianity being humbug, these were the verses that God used. Humbug is hypocritical, by the way. And don't we feel like that so often? That we're frauds. Now we get worse. Why is it like this? The description in this psalm is of a battle. And Jesus Christ is described here as a warrior. That's what we need to get into our heads. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors. That's the gate of heaven, everlasting. It leads to life eternal, and it lasts forever. And the King of Glory shall come in. And then, who is this King of Glory? This is how he's described. The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. Now, let me use this illustration, because I think it'll help some. When there's a war on, we don't all fight on the front line. Think of the First World War, that great war which we've been commemorating recently. And the soldiers representing our country, going to the trenches. Now, the victory depends on the outcome of the battle on the front line. Now, we are not fighting there, but our position is dependent on what they do. We are represented by them. To give a slightly different illustration, not as important, think of a football match. When we're told that England didn't do very well in the World Cup, it didn't mean that everybody in England was playing in Brazil. The English football team, which consists of I don't know how many people, represents the rest of the country. And this is exactly the same in this spiritual battle. There was a representative, Adam. He was put in paradise, and everything was perfect and very good. And Adam and Eve were innocents. And God said, if you obey me and keep my commandments, then you will go on and inherit all of this. But if you disobey me, then in dying you shall surely die. And Adam was representing, like those soldiers, like a football team, the rest of us. And we know the story, don't we? I want to put it poetically because sometimes it helps. In Eden. Do you know this? Sad indeed that day. My countless blessings fled away. My crown fell in disgrace. I had the privilege of singing that in Badacen, that institution in Moldova, where the effects of the fall are even more graphic than here. You'd hear screams in the night coming from that building as people were abused. That's why in Adam we all fell. Adam has no rights now to enter into that kingdom of heaven. There are two swords drawn barring the entrance from paradise. Now, that's where we must begin tonight. This is the bad news that comes before the good news. And we're all in this. That is why I can never understand people who say that the gospel somehow isn't relevant anymore. Well, what do you need to make it more applicable? If in Adam we all die, if death is as a result of the fall of our first Adam, our representative, what could be more relevant than that? That man is appointed once to die, and after that, the judgment. We've all got the mark of the fall upon us, the mark of Cain. We are all sinners by nature because of what our forefather did. Now, that's not where we're stopping tonight. Thank God for that. You know, I've been to some churches And all you'll hear is about what we do. Oh, there is more. In Eden sad indeed that day, my countless blessings fled away, my crown fell in disgrace. The hymn doesn't stop there. If it did, we'd give up in despair. It goes on to say, but on victorious Calvary, that crown was won again for me. My life shall all be praise. God sends a second Adam into the battle, Jesus Christ. And this is where we come to the psalm. You see, when there was that silence in heaven in Revelation and John is weeping because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it, one of the elders said to him, "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed." And that's what I want to tell you tonight, that Jesus Christ is the one who was victorious. Let us go through what he accomplished. Oh, don't you love sometimes to read the accounts of great battles, to read of the exploits of brave soldiers? And here are exploits that not even the most courageous of soldiers in this world's battle has ever accomplished. What did this soldier do? Well, he left his home in glory. He came down into the battle, into this sin-sick world. He came to the front line. Oh, what commander does that in a war? And more than that, he became a man. What humiliation for the eternal Son of God to become one of us. That's how far he humbled himself. And not only did he become one of us, he put himself under the law. He lived as any of us would live. He didn't live in the palace. He lived in poverty in Nazareth. He worked with his hands. He was a carpenter for most of his life. And he was doing all of this in order to keep the law for us. His hands were clean. His hearts were pure. His motives were always God-honoring and for the sake of those round about him. And he humbled himself so far that he went to the cross, and it was on that tree that he fought. That's where the victory was won. That was the crux of the battle. That was the Stalingrad of this battle, the turning point. Because it was on victorious Calvary that he dealt with what the devil had against us, our sin. He took it upon himself. He took all the poison. And now the devil has nothing against us. He's paid the price. Didn't we sing that in the first hymn? Oh, isn't there a reason for rejoicing in a gospel service? Oh, listen to this. Rejoice and be glad, for the blood hath been shed. That blood which signifies that a sacrifice has been made. Redemption is finished. The price has been paid. And he rose from the dead and ascended into heaven. And this is what this psalm is looking at. After his victory on the cross, he's coming to the gates and the doors of heaven. And he now, unlike the first Adam, who could only bow down his head in shame and run away from the holiness of God, the second Adam, who is the last Adam, because there needs no other fighter, says, "I demand entrance." I found this in one of Spurgeon's sermons. I don't know how applicable it is today. But apparently in the 19th century, if the King of England was to go from Temple Bar, which was probably in the west end of London, I stand to be corrected, into the city of London, the gates of the city would have been walled, would have been shut, and the porter would have asked, "Who goes there?" This is what Mr. Spurgeon says in his sermon. And the King of England would have said, "It is the King." And immediately the porter would open the door The king has gone through the gates. He's victorious. We've had the privilege of President Obama visiting South Wales. And all the fences, I don't know how it was in Cardiff, but between Chepstow and Cardiff, there wasn't a motorway bridge without policemen on it. Police vans everywhere. I heard that there was even a battleship in the bay. The most powerful man in the free world being shut out from everybody else. The King of Kings opening the gates for everybody else. That is what I'm amazed at here. Let me just give you some verses. It's a children's hymn. This sums up the gospel so well. Who is worthy? Who has clean hands? Who can fulfill these criteria? Think of the exams that many of you have had to endure. And I'm sure you are relieved now that the results have come through. Now, what's the pass mark to enter into the kingdom of heaven? Well, it isn't 50%. It isn't 70%. It is even 90%. It is 100%. And none of us will ever be good enough for that. But he is, as that children's hymn says, there was none other good enough to pay the price of sin. He only could unlock the gate of heaven and let us in. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord, strong and mighty, mighty in battle. The same description is used of God after the crossing of the Red Sea in the Song of Moses. He's described as a man of war, mighty in battle. The crossing of the Red Sea, again, is a symbol of the redemption that we have in Jesus Christ. And this is the hope that I'm setting before us tonight. We are never going to be good enough. We are never going to be able to stand before God and claim that we can have an entrance into heaven. Even if we say that we'll try, when we get there, we will find that we're not even able to look into his face and live. Our God is a consuming fire, and who can dwell with everlasting burnings? But this is the key. If we're looking to Christ, if we're depending on Christ, if he is our merit, then through him we have an entrance as well. Oh, let me quote another hymn. These hymns have it all, you know. I see the bar to heaven removed, and all thy merits, Lord, are mine. Death. Aren't you fearful of death? Oh, during dark nights when your mind is wandering and you're worried about everything, isn't death there? That one day I'll have to die. Death of death. That's who Jesus Christ is. Death, hell, hell's destruction, and sin are now subdued. All grace is now to sinners given. And lo, I, even I, sinner that I am, plead the atoning blood, and in thy rights I claim my heaven. On victorious Calvary, that crown was won again for me. My life shall all be praised. Oh, my friends, I want every one of us here tonight to be trusting in Jesus Christ, to have that confidence that because he is worthy, I can through him enter into heaven. Is anybody here not sure that they have this hope of heaven? If we die without Christ, we have to face eternal judgment. But the weakest believer who is trusting in him has immediate access to heaven. Let me say this. Again, this is according to the commentators. Doors were often taken from their hinges when the Easterns, that's the Bible lands, would show welcome to a guest. So when the psalmist here says, "Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors. It's because of the occasion, because this is such an important guest, the King of Kings, because it's such a welcome that he's receiving. He's victorious over all our enemies, that the gates are not sufficient to allow him entrance. They've got to be taken off their hinges. Isn't that great? That's why they are to be lifted up. And this is the illustration here. The picture is highly poetical and shows how wide the gate is set by the ascension of our Lord. Blessed be God, says Spurgeon. The gates have never been shut since. The opened gates of heaven invite the weakest believer to enter in. The gates are wide open. His mercy all, immense and free. Can you say this? For, oh my God, it found out me. We don't have a reason to stay away from Christ because he only is worthy. Because he came for sinners, not righteous people, and because the weakest of us, putting our trust in him, are represented now by him rather than the first Adam. Oh, don't you love having such a savior, such an older brother, such a beloved? Mighty Christ. Mighty from time eternal. But you know what? It's not just the gates of heaven that he's entered into. There are other gates here tonight. What Christ has done for us is not going to do any of us good unless other gates are open to him. And that's the gate of our hearts. He said, writing to the church in Laodicea, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. He that opens to me, I will come in and sup." That's a description of faith, opening our hearts to Jesus Christ. Somebody put it like this: Christ's work for us will not profit unless he works in us. He is mighty, and only he can change our hearts. Our hearts have been taken over by self, by the devil. He's the strong man armed. And only one person is strong enough to overthrow him, and that's King Jesus, the King of Grace. You can't do it. I can't do it for you. Some of us have tried. We've tried making ourselves better, but we've failed miserably, like George Whitfield and the Holy Club. We found ourselves going farther away from the kingdom. But when, out of desperation, we say, "Jesus, I cannot do it. I'm trusting in you. You come into my heart and deliver me from sin. I don't just want to be saved from the guilt and the consequences of sin. I want to be saved from the power of sin." And when we do that, he comes in. You know, if you've got a light bulb, and if you smash that light bulb, it pops. Because there's a vacuum inside, and a vacuum can't exist by itself. And that's all it takes. If you look at this glass of water, which I used as an illustration this morning, a different picture now, because this glass is full of water, it can't be filled with anything else. It must first, I'm not going to do it, be emptied, and then it can be filled with water. And if we want to be saved tonight, then we cannot be full of self. We cannot be full of sin. We cannot be full of pride. We cannot be full of righteousness. We must come as we are, empty, nothing in my hands I bring. Simply to thy cross I cling. I just want to finish with an illustration that I found so encouraging. I just want to read from Mr. Spurgeon's sermon. I'm in danger of making Spurgeon my hero, but if he takes us closer to Christ, that's not a bad thing. Now, listen, we are very much alike, you know, after all. We're all in the same boat. And is it not wonderful that grace saves? It's all of grace. And then he goes on to say this. If we once get our hearts filled with a true wonder that Christ should have saved sinners at all, that he should condescend to display that wonderful grace by ostensibly such great sinners, Jesus Christ will come in. Well, but suppose he should not, says one. Ah, never suppose what cannot be. Him that cometh unto me, I will in no wise cast out. Why, the very angels must sometimes be astonished as they say, Lord, here is such a one coming. Shall we shut the gates? Is that you, I wonder? Even though you've not committed any gross outward sins, you know in your heart, you're vile. And you can imagine the angels saying, will we open the gates to him? And Jesus says, yes. No, we will not shut the gates. Yes. We will open it, for I have said that he that cometh, I will in no wise cast out. Surely, when the angel of mercy saw Saul of Tarsus coming, he said, Lord, here is a man who's had his garments bespattered with the blood of many of the saints. Here comes this blasphemer, this persecutor. Must not he be excluded? No, Jesus says. The gates stood open, and he found admittance, and he entered, and he turned round and said to the others who were timidly standing outside, I obtained mercy, that in me first Jesus Christ might show forth all longsuffering for a pattern to them which should hereafter believe, and then for us. O soul, if thou desirest to have Christ, there is no reason why thou should not have him. Nay, thou shalt have him, if thou hast got so far by his grace as to have said, lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be lift up, ye everlasting doors. Then the King of glory shall come in. Onward march, all-conquering Jesus, gird thee on thy mighty sword. Free my soul from sin's foul bondage. Hasten now the glorious dawn. Break proud Babel's gates in sunder. Let the massive bolts be drawn. Is it okay, Brian, if I change the hymn? 465. 465.